You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The saying is, there's no such thing as a free lunch, but as is so often the case with comforting phrases like that, they turn out not to be completely true. Investigative journalist and two-time Pulitzer Prize winner David K. Johnson has called his latest book Free Lunch, but it's his subtitle that reveals the real subject, how the wealthiest Americans enrich themselves at government expense and stick you with the bill. It's published by Penguin Press, and it brings David K. Johnson back to the show today, just 2 weeks before the tax filing deadline, which probably won't affect many of the people he's written about in this book. Hi, it's always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you, Leonard.
I understand you're leaving the Times, but wasn't the tax beat your main area at the Times?
Oh, yes. No, I spent the last 13 years examining taxes and subsidies, regulation, things that are all related to that. And early on, I did pensions, but we now have somebody doing that very, very well.
Your previous book was called Perfectly Legal, The Covert Campaign to Rig Our Tax System to Benefit the Super Rich and Cheat Everybody Else. This covers, obviously, it's been rigged in a lot of different ways, because this covers a whole bunch of other kinds of stories.
Well, yes. Perfectly Legal was about inflow or lack of inflow to the government from some people. And Free Lunch is about subsidies, taxes you pay that never get to the government but are diverted to very wealthy Americans or corporations, and government rules that rig markets and essentially drive up the price of various things.
And you make the point that this has been a bipartisan effort?
Oh, absolutely. For example, Bill Clinton signed a law that gave the very, very super richest 1,000 Americans a tax cut 60% bigger than all the Bush cuts combined.
So why do we talk about Reagan and Bush as the two big tax cutters?
Well, because they had mass tax cuts that affected very large numbers of people. The Bush tax cuts so far are not tax cuts. They are deferrals. All of the Bush tax cuts have been financed with borrowed money. So all the government did, as it's doing with the stimulus package, was borrow the money you didn't pay. That's an implicit tax on the future with interest.
Now, what about the Middle Class Tax Relief Act, which was passed during the Clinton years, 1997? Did the middle class benefit at all from that?
Somewhat, particularly families with children. There was the Republicans promoted a tax credit that's now $1,000 per child. And so for middle-class families, people making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $75,000, yes, indeed, there was a benefit.
Now, it's been pointed out, I think there was a study done by Congress, the investigative part of Congress, that revealed that the tax cuts really have benefited the top 1% of all Americans. But everybody has gotten a bit of tax relief. It's just that the middle class is... tax relief hasn't been all that much, and it's been creeping up.
That's right. The tax cuts that President Bush sponsored, remember, came in several tranches. The last one was a tax cut on capital, and about 7% of all capital gains in America go to 400 taxpayers. A third of them go to about 10,000. I think it's a very small number. I think it's 10,000 taxpayers, and those disproportionately benefited people at the very top. But the salient important factor is that these tax cuts have not paid for themselves. In fact, the average income of Americans in 2005 was smaller than it was in 2000.
So what happened to the trickle-down theory that was touted during the Reagan years? And we still hear about it every once in a while.
Well, actually, trickle-down was a criticism of Reagan, and I contend that it is fundamentally flawed, because what these policies have resulted in is not trickle down, but Amazon up. And these tremendous increases in income. The bottom 90% of Americans' average income is the same today, adjusted for inflation, as it was in 1980. But at the very top, incomes are five times what they were in 1980.
But the main thrust of this book is how taxpayers are subsidizing some of the wealthiest people in our society.
Absolutely.
That goes beyond simply giving them tax relief.
That's exactly right. It's giving them tax dollars. So that when you walk into many of the new big box retail stores and sometimes whole shopping centers now, the sales taxes that you pay at the cash register never get to the government. Instead, they are used to pay the cost of building the store. And while those deals are in effect, the store is exempt from property taxes typically. And so think about that for a minute. The Walton family controls Walmart, and the company has said that about for one out of three of its stores, it seeks this deal. Now, they're the richest family in America, and yet you and I are subsidizing them. We're giving up involuntarily through taxes part of our money to them. It's one thing to have to give up money for the disabled, the elderly, the poor, children who need to be educated, but for the Walton family?
And the reason that this happens is because different municipalities see this as an opportunity to provide jobs and help many of the local industries, construction and whatever.
That's the assertion. In the case of retail, all these things do is concentrate jobs at a particular location, and the governments don't go and examine, well, what other businesses failed. I tell the story in a free lunch of somebody who charged a lower price than Cabela's, a big national chain that sells hunting and fishing goods. Cabela's store came to town with a $32 million subsidy and ran him out of business and therefore destroyed the jobs of himself and his employees.
And we all know that Walmart does not pay as well as many other people.
Yes, and not in the fringe benefits area either. And, you know, if the object is to create jobs, I mean, I have a terrific job creation program, Leonard. Quit subsidizing the Walton family. Let's just ban earth-moving equipment and require that all earth-moving construction sites be done with spoons.
Now, we are very pleased that both the Yankees and the Mets are going to have new stadiums next year. They're in the process of being built. How much of the cost is being borne by the Yankees and the Mets?
Very little. The Yankee Stadium subsidy, originally it was asserted there was none, and then it was the Independent Budget Office had it around 200 and some million. When my book was written, it was 600 million. I see the latest number is more than $800 million of subsidy to George Steinbrenner and the other owners of the team.
Now, he's a multi-billionaire as well.
Oh, yes. And the beneficiaries of most of these subsidies are very, very wealthy people. I mean, these are policies that take from the many to give to the few and allow them to raise and charge higher prices after they get the subsidy.
Now, what's the rationalization for giving them so many subsidies? They're just going to take the team and move elsewhere?
Well, all the big sports leagues, football, baseball, basketball, and hockey, control the market. They are not subject to competition. So in theory, you could move, but I mean, who's going to go see the Cleveland Yankees?
Yeah, but the Yankees can move to New Jersey. The Giants and the Jets both did. They still call themselves the New York Giants and the New York Jets.
Yeah, they could.
And George Steinbrenner was threatening to do that, wasn't he?
That's right. But if we had a free market in commercial sports the way they do in England, we would see lower ticket prices and a vibrant market instead of a protected market that drives up prices, causes people to pay much more for tickets and ancillary services than if we had a real competitive market.
Now, this happens a lot, but every once in a while it is stopped. The Jets wanted to build a stadium on the west side of Manhattan, and it didn't happen.
And the voters in Seattle turned down a subsidy for the Sonics, and instead a subsidy was voted by the voters in Oklahoma City, so that team's going to move to Oklahoma City. So long as these leagues are able to control who can own a team and where they're located, especially so long as football doesn't have a team in Los Angeles, they can use this to extract subsidies.
Are there any sports teams that, because they're all owned by billionaires, aren't they?
There's one football team owned by people in Green Bay that wouldn't qualify, but that's the general gist of it. Yes, they're owned by extremely wealthy people.
And in the case of Green Bay, does the public benefit from the fact that it owns the football team?
I don't know. I have not examined the finances of that team.
Do we benefit in any way from tax dollars after we help subsidize these stadiums?
I would argue that no, it's an absolute detriment. And all of the research done by lots of economists going back 30 years shows that. And it damages other businesses. We had a baseball strike back 14 years ago. And that summer, business at nightclubs and bars and video arcades that don't get subsidies, it flourished.
My guest is David K. Johnson, who is a Pulitzer Prize winner with the New York Times for the past 13 years, although he is leaving in a week?
End of next week.
To write more books.
Absolutely.
And the latest one is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. It is published by Portfolio. So has it always been thus? When the house that Ruth built Was that built by the Yankees at the time, or was that paid for with taxpayer dollars? Was Ebbets Field with Polo Grounds paid for with taxpayer dollars?
Leonard, I can't tell you the deep history of that. What I can tell you is that in the 50s and 60s, in the early 70s, we had far fewer and smaller subsidies. There were some subsidies, often land acquisition if you were building a new stadium. And there were a number of stadiums, football and baseball, that were built entirely with private money. And the size of these subsidies is growing tremendously. It now exceeds $2 billion a year, which is more than the profits of the big four sports.
I guess if we were getting a lot of money back, it would be different. I would think that if a deal was struck, you know, well, we will give you so much money, we get so much money back. You build it yourself, you get all the money for yourself. Then a lot of these billionaires might be more inclined to build it themselves.
Well, I think they're not building it themselves because there's a free lunch out there to be had, and they're using their political pull and influence to force money out of the taxpayers. And in many cases, rather than getting direct payments, they get lease deals that essentially give them the use of a building for free.
Now, how is this any different than a bank saying, we're going to move all our operations out of New York City, or an automobile company manufacturer saying, we're going to leave Detroit if you don't give us a tax break, and we're going to move to Tennessee?
I don't think that they're materially different. And the problem is that that's not market capitalism. We are evolving a system here where government is picking the winners and losers. Government is making decisions about the market that ought to be made by the market. And if it's a sound investment, the market will invest the money. If it's not a sound investment, why should you and I be forced to pay taxes to subsidize it?
In a number of cases, we've given all sorts of tax breaks to a company to stay, and then they've left anyway before... long before they promised that they would.
That's right.
Do they ever get penalized?
No, very rarely. There have been a few cases where some givebacks have been demanded, but generally there's no follow-up and there's no penalty for violating the rules.
How long has this been going on? Is that Cole Porter?
Well, I can show you specific examples of things all throughout the history of the Republic. But we had a big round of this in the late 1800s with the railroads. It led to the New York State Constitution having a provision that prohibits gifts to companies. The resurgence of this has been since about 1980. And it's getting bigger and worse, and it is depriving us of money for things that government needs to provide. Parks, recreation, education, other police services, other services.
You write for the New York Times. Do you think you could have written this if you worked for the Wall Street Journal?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. But haven't people criticized you for going after the rich unfairly?
Well, there are certain people who think I've gone after the rich unfairly. What I've tried to do is I don't have any aversion to rich whatsoever. But if you're going to go get rich, make the money by having a better product or a better service and compete in the market. Don't get Congress or the legislature to pass a law that sticks a hand in my pocket and forces me to give you money. You know, we can argue about how much we should do that for the elderly and the disabled and people who can't provide for themselves, but what moral justification is there from taking from those with less to give to billionaires?
Over the years, David K. Johnston has hunted down a killer that police failed to catch, exposed Los Angeles Police Department abuses, caused two television stations to lose their licenses over news manipulation, revealed Donald Trump's true net worth. He has uncovered many tax dodges that... has led him to be called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States. His latest book, Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill, is published by Portfolio, which is a division of Penguin. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David K. Johnston. His latest book is called Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill from Portfolio, which is an imprint of Penguin Books. So let's talk about some of the other things that you cover in this book. For example, health care. Have these policies benefiting the rich had an impact on our health care system?
Oh, enormously so. First of all, we've created a whole group of billionaires who I name in the book from gifts of public money to the healthcare system that the taxpayers made, and then allowing people to buy assets for, in one case, a tiny fraction of a penny on the dollar. Secondly, we have a healthcare system that, according to both the CIA, an impeccably pro-American source, and McKinsey, the most prestigious business consultant in America, is far and away the most expensive. By some measures, our healthcare system ranks down with such leading nations of the world as Croatia and below Cuba. And we still have 47 million people without insurance, and lots of people who cannot leave their job for another job or won't because of a pre-existing condition.
Well, we had a number of opportunities to change the healthcare system, and the lobbyists and the healthcare system just came down on it. I'm not sure whether Hillary Clinton's plan was a good one. Many people think it was a bad one, but she has a new plan, and Barack Obama has a plan. Do you think we're ever going to clean that thing up?
Well, one of the questions I think we need to start thinking about is business people complain all the time about all the time and attention and resources they have to devote to healthcare, small business owners. Well, guess what, folks? Then why don't be like the rest of the modern world? Everybody else has figured out how to provide high-quality, low-cost healthcare except us. It's hurting us competitively. And if you're in a small business, you don't want to be negotiating healthcare contracts. You want to run your business.
Another thing you look at is the student loan industry, which has been the subject of some legal investigation recently.
Yes. Well, you know, when you and I went to college, it was free, basically. Now we make people borrow money, and the terms are so onerous that Sallie Mae makes an average return over the last 5 years of 51%. Big banks only average 17% because the government's rigged the rules in favor of Sallie Mae. A 51% return on equity is just extraordinary, and what we're doing is discouraging a lot of people from getting education that would make the country better off. If it weren't for women getting advanced degrees, the number of advanced degrees in America would be falling. This is simply not sound policy to put obstacles in the way of developing human capital.
So this goes beyond secret deals made between the student loan companies and the loan advisors at the university.
That's right. But the reason you have those secret deals is that whenever you have a subsidy, Adam Smith told us in 1776 in The Wealth of Nations, people go after the subsidy and they mine it. And so you get kickback arrangements and all sorts of other unsavory arrangements because you're trying to get this money from the subsidy. And who gets hurt? America overall and young people trying to improve themselves through education.
You write about Warren Buffett, a man who's admired for his business sense and his philanthropy in recent years. How has he benefited from taxpayers' money? I thought he was just an investor.
Well, he is an investor, but he didn't make all that money by being Pollyanna. Last year, he got a $100 million gift of New York State tax money up in Buffalo for a call center for his Geico insurance company. His utility company got a $250 million interest-free loan, and he only has to pay half of it back 24 years from now. And in Iowa, his utility, some people tried to organize because they felt it was charging 40% more than was reasonable, and to fight this. And Mr. Buffett's people got the two leaders of the Iowa legislature to tell the Iowa Association of Municipal Utilities, if you ever help these people any further or anyone else ever again to interfere with Mr. Buffett's business, we're going to tax you out of business. And so they passed a resolution promising to never again question Mr. Buffett's behavior.
Well, this is a pretty big story. Why haven't we heard more about it?
It's in Iowa, and the news media basically is contracting in this country, unfortunately. I think it's a very big story. It's been not well told in the Iowa newspapers.
In fact, it's been contracting at the New York Times.
Yes, it has.
People like you are being bought out.
I took a buyout to go do books, and there will be more contraction, I'm sure, down the road.
And it's interesting to me that the Times took offered you a buyout. You've won two Pulitzer Prizes.
Well, one Pulitzer shared with others and another one.
It's the kind of thing that newspapers like the New York Times generally brag about. We have so many Pulitzer Prize winners on our staff.
Well, it was also time for me to go on and do something else. I've been a reporter in L.A. for 40 years.
Now, is what George Steinbrenner is doing, or Warren Buffett, or what the student loan industry is doing, are any of those things illegal?
No. The big scandal is always what's legal. And all of these things are legal. But I don't think very many Americans know that they are being forced to give money to these billionaires through these systems because they have not been well written about. And where they have been, they tend to be written about in bureaucratic ways that don't explain to people what's really going on.
Can you talk a bit about CSX?
CSX, one of the biggest railroads in the country.
Most people don't even know that it's a railroad. I wasn't sure whether, when I first saw the name, whether it was the new version of U.S. Steel.
Right. All these alphabet soup companies, you don't know what business they're in. But they're one of the biggest freight railroads in the country, and Amtrak pays to run passenger trains over their rails. There was an accident in South Carolina. Seven people died, and about 77 people were injured. Everybody got a settlement except one widow who fought, got all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court with her case, because she didn't believe this was an accident. Lo and behold, it turns out that under John Snow, who went on to become Treasury Secretary, CSX cut safety and cut it, and they were told by people inside, they were told by the Federal Railroad Administration, you're making things dangerous, don't do this. Mr. Snow stuck to his reduced safety policy, and it turned out that the accident that killed the man in question, a Miami police sergeant, had gone 10 years. A railroad junction had been held together with a rusty nail instead of a bolt. A jury awarded $50 million in punitive damages. A judge called it borderline criminal. Other judges upheld this decision. And it turns out that you and I paid the $50 million because even if Amtrak has a safe train going below the speed limit with a sober crew and the accident is 100% the fault of CSX or any other railroad, the bill is turned over to the taxpayers. That's one reason they could cut spending on safety. No connection between risk and reward. And in this case, literally people dying so that CSX could get a subsidy.
Is that because it was built into some federal law?
Yes. When the railroads wanted to get out of the passenger business, one of the deals that Congress gave them was total and complete immunity and responsibility. Not you're not responsible unless it's your bad care of the railroad, but total and complete. So the taxpayers get stuck with the bill even though the taxpayers' company, Amtrak, did nothing wrong.
It's a good deal.
It's an extraordinary deal if you're CSX. It's a very bad deal for you and I because we're both in danger and we're paying for the dangerous conditions.
My guest is David K. Johnston, whose latest book is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. It's published by Portfolio, which is a division of Penguin Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Can I ask you some of the questions our listeners have been writing
sure.
in? One person writes, current and future taxes are paying for the U.S. military and war operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. World War II was largely paid with U.S. war bonds. Is it a misuse of tax dollars to fund wars instead of selling war bonds? My question would be, is there any difference ultimately? Don't you just have to wind up paying for it down the line?
Yeah, the war bonds had to be paid off with future taxes down the road. And we're borrowing money to finance this war, which is no different than the war bonds. We're just not selling it on a mass basis to ordinary people with patriotic fervor, because I don't think you'd sell very many of them based on the polls on what people think about the necessity of that war.
But in the end, it winds up costing pretty much the same sort of thing.
That's exactly correct.
Another caller says, in New York City, what do we consider income-wise to be middle class? $100,000? $200,000?
Well, that's a good question. New York is an extraordinary and unusual case. It is also a huge moneymaker for the federal government. New York produces far more taxes than it costs for the federal government to provide services to New York. And I would think in Manhattan, certainly, $100,000 is still very much a middle-class salary. One of the things I do, Leonard, is segregate the top 1%, which starts nationwide at $300,000 and change, and the super rich. The top 10th of 1% is $1.6 million and above. The top 100th of 1% is about $5 million and above, and their average income is around $27 million. Those people live in a totally different world than someone making $300,000 and change.
Another caller wants to know if you'd be in favor of a flat tax if it was only on wealth, not on income.
Well, it's very hard to tax wealth because how are you going to measure wealth?
And it can be hidden,
and it can,
as you pointed out in a previous book.
Absolutely, and we have huge fights over, for example, property tax values or business values. Income may not be the best way to do this, but there is a moral principle to higher tax rates for higher income. When Athens was a tyranny, everyone paid the exact same tax. The Athenians realized this was causing terrible problems and that the rich, it was a trifle to them and a burden to everybody else. And they developed the moral principle that There is no economic gain without society. The greater your gain from a civilization, the greater your moral duty to support that civilization with your taxes. So there is a moral principle involved.
Can you talk a bit about how taxpayers are creating huge profits for the burglar alarm industry?
Oh, yeah. America gives $500 million a year of free labor to Tyco, which was at the center of the Wall Street scandals, because when a burglar alarm goes off, and one out of four burglar alarms is monitored by Tyco, all they do is call your house or to say, is everything okay? Then they send the police. Well, those police calls cost $50 each on average. It's over $2 billion a year, so $500 million to Tyco. 99% of burglar alarms are false. And when the police do arrive, the average response time nationwide is about 34 minutes. The average burglary takes 5. If Tyco charged its customers and paid the full price, who'd care? But we're diverting police resources to this. And furthermore, we've been strangling recreation programs for young people. So I show in Free Lunch how the rise of violent youth gangs in Los Angeles and some other cities is intimately connected with draining money off to Tyco and sports teams owners and others.
Why don't police departments refuse to cooperate with Tyco?
Well, effectively, the police have their ways of dealing with things. They've been slowing down the response time. So they're
But ultimately, the person who's paying Tyco money is the one who winds up being the real loser.
That's right. And, but also remember that 4 out of 5 homes don't have a burglar alarm. So that means that 4 out of 5 people are paying for a service that goes to a handful of others.
Now, Congress could do something about this. And when Congress changed hands not all that long ago, it was assumed that something would be done to the tax code and to some of these built-in loopholes. I understand Harry Reid made promises, and then he went to visit a conference or a convention in Las Vegas and changed his mind.
Well, I think the core problem with Congress is that members of Congress depend not on voters because they mostly come from safe districts. This is an unusual election this year, but if you're a D, you can get reelected forever, and if you're an R, you can get reelected forever. We don't have competitive districts. And the real constituency of members of Congress are the donors, and those are the people they listen to. Those are the people whose concerns. It's like being in love, you know. You're worried about the other. Well, you know, they're in love with the donors who keep them in office, and they worry about their concerns, not yours and not mine.
And lobbyists as an extension of the donors?
The lobbyists are an extension of it. They're brokers who bundle money up for people. There's a whole industry. When in 2000, there were about 17,000 registered lobbyists in Washington. There are now more than 35,000. What other industry in America has doubled in size since 2000?
Ronald Reagan said that government is not the solution. Government is the problem.
Well, so, government's a problem. I mean, I spent my whole career writing, but government's a problem.
Yeah, but Ronald Reagan is the Republican that every Republican candidate cites as a role model, an ideal. Did he live up to that, or has any Republican in power lived up to that ideal since?
No. In fact, what's called non-discretionary, non-defense spending, George Bush is the biggest spender since Johnson, and he may be bigger than Johnson. He's certainly
Well, he has a
league.
Different war.
No, non-defense. Discretionary spending. That's what I'm talking about. The biggest office building in Washington, D.C. is named for Reagan. I don't think President Reagan would have approved of some of the specific things that have been done, rigged markets and electricity and other things. But in his name, a whole host of policies have been put in place that are transferring wealth and income to the wealthy through government policy.
Well, what effect does this have on our trade?
Not good at all. Just the healthcare issue, for example. We've lost auto factories to Ontario. Ontario, Canada, is replacing Detroit as the auto manufacturing center of the world.
Because GM realizes it will cut back on its healthcare bill considerably by simply moving to Canada where there's a different system.
Well, what happens is there's no healthcare bill for them at all. I mean, there's a healthcare cost, but it's borne not on the books of the company, but on the books of the government. And they don't have to run a healthcare program or spend any money on it or any management effort on it. And so our products are being disadvantaged by the system.
Can these freebies be undone by a new administration?
Yes. Every problem we have, we can solve so long as we're a democracy. That's the whole idea of creating America, is we can govern ourselves. The worst thing that I see happening is this notion of, oh, they're so powerful, the lobbyists and the big companies and the rich. We just can't do anything about it. Nonsense. It won't be easy, but we can get a government that's responsive to the people.
We can. I saw that movie. That was a fantasy movie, The American President.
I still think that we can. You know, we got rid of slavery. Women talked men into giving them the right to vote. It took a long time.
We got rid of slavery, and then we destroyed Reconstruction.
Yes.
There's always, you take a step forward, you take a couple of steps back,
or maybe you take two forward and a half of one back. But the important issue is Americans have to decide to stop outsourcing citizenship to the wealthy and those with a financial interest in government and participate in their government.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, David K. Johnson. His latest book is Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense, and Stick You with the Bill, published by Portfolio, an imprint of Penguin Press. You said there's another book on the way?
Part of the reason I'm leaving the New York Times is to get the next one out sooner. It'll be the third in this series, and then I have other things I want to do.
And I look forward to seeing you to talk about that book.
I hope you invite me back.